And this John McMullen broadcasting from high above beautiful downtown Lake Osceola in Jefferson Valley, New York. Good evening. This is the 119th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. Through our rails for the previous 118 shows may be found at www.13.com. That's www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is JohnMac. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. My most recent piece for the Westchester Guardian is at website www.westchesterguardian.com. Westchester Guardian is WestchesterGuardian. That's all one word, .com. It includes the 190th column, the Creative Disruption Series. But I hope you'll read the column, and if desired, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And once again, John Mack is JohnMac. You'll find links to the previous radio shows and to my online newspaper at my web home. That's www.johnmack13.com. And now to this show, the 119th in the series. Callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. That's 746-716-9756. Over the past 2.5 years, many folks from Inwood, my neighborhood growing up in New York City, have been featured on the weekly radio show, along with writers, academics, and educators, members of the clergy, and politicians. I could never, however, have more than the smattering of the many people who've touched my life during my own years in Inwood. So tonight is an attempt, hopefully somewhat successfully, to bring together the number of people to relate stories and share memories of their Inwood experience. For those who don't know Inwood's story, Inwood is the northernmost most neighborhood of Manhattan Island, but not surprisingly of the borough of Manhattan. The neighborhood of Marble Hill resides on New York City's mainland, where the borough of the Bronx is the only borough totally on the mainland. Yet Marble Hill is part of the borough of Manhattan. The Harlem River separates Manhattan from the Bronx, but the river in days of yore was the narrow river with a different path. At that time, Marble Hill was physically detached to Manhattan Island and was joined by something known as the King's Bridge. And then they moved the river to expand this path, what was known as the Harlem River Barge Canal, and Marble Hill was joined to the mainland. Moreover, a peninsula that had been in the Bronx was attached to what became Inwood Hill Park and became known as the island to those of us who grew up in Inwood. In the late 1930s, James Lyons, who was the borough president of the Bronx, reacted to part of the mainland being Manhattan, and threatened if the city council did not detach Marble Hill to the Bronx to occupy with his own forces, which were police officer. Then World War II came, and it was largely forgotten about until years later. Years later, I happened to be at the wedding up in Riverdale, high over this area, and the judge performing the ceremony, one Theodore Kupperman, who was deformed but congressman, who succeeded John Lindsay in what was known as the Silk Stocking District, was looking out the window, and I pointed down and I said, "Do you see that neighborhood?" He said, "Yes, that's Marble Hill." And I said, "Well, that used to be long." Then he said, "I know the story." And I went into the Lyons story. laughed, and he said, "Well, there's a little more to it than that." He said, "Did you know that the reason that that Lyons got involved was the freshman in Dewitt Clinton High School wrote the letter to New York Times demanding why that area was part of Manhattan, and then after reading the letter, then Borough President Lyons got involved." And he looked at me and said, "Then I was that freshman." But things haven't changed. I have a caller on from Connecticut, but originally from Inwood. Dennis O'Sullivan.
Yes, John. How are you?
I'm here, and Dennis was in the first grade the year that I was. He actually started a half a year ahead of me, and then grew up within 10 blocks of me. What was unique to Inwood, if anything, Dennis, about you growing up in that neighborhood?
Well, I think looking back and making this evaluation previously, it was Inwood Hill Park. And I called it, I remember writing a composition, I don't know where the heck I was writing it for, but I called it the Mecca of Manhattan, because it was where we spent an awful lot of time, mostly playing baseball, riding our bikes, going up to the Indian caves, just basically spending a lot of time prior to us getting involved with going to high school and getting a job where a lot of the young boys, what they did was they started a freshman year in high school, found out they needed some money, so they got a job delivering groceries, delivering meat, and I followed their trend. But I was always involved in baseball. I was in the Little League. I was, if I may digress, John, is that permitted?
Oh, of course.
I was on, we had some very good baseball players, and one of them, many people remember John Cregan, and John was a real good baseball player. He had a way with pitching. He could throw a curveball, and my role in his development was I was his catcher. And I remember that we made, John Cregan and I, made the Inwood All-Stars when we were probably in the Little League time frame. And I think Little League goes up to about 10, 11, 12, in that range. And one of the things I keep on telling my grandson now, and he'd like to wring my neck when I tell him the story again, is that I did play baseball at Yankee Stadium. And what it was the Inwood All-Star Little League team played the Bronx All-Star Little League team. And John Cregan and I, and I would, if I was prompted, if I had to look back on some of the papers that I've got, I would remember other fellows. And what we did was we each played about one or two innings. And I remember the remarkable thing about it was that the Yankees were very generous with their time. We did not, we were not located in the Yankee dugout. We were in the dugout for the visiting team on the third baseline. And however, the guy that was calling balls and strikes was Yogi Berra. And what he did was he just had his mask on. And what he did was he grabbed the catcher by his belt. And if the ball came low, you went low. If the ball came to the right, you went to the right. And so forth and so on, because he was like a fire plug. He was broad and strong, but a real, a real nice guy. And I remember all of the Yankees, I didn't have a real understanding of their prominence, but I do remember Yogi Berra, and that was a nice story. So for me, Inwood Hill Park was the Mecca of Manhattan. It was where I spent an awful lot of time. I remember with my father. My father worked for the transit system, and he had 6 weeks or 4 weeks vacation, I can't remember which. And as little kids, we went up to the park with my father down to the lower field, and he spread out the blanket, and you just you went over and you played in the river, or you played in the bay over there, or you went into the woods, and there was a stream coming out, and you used to make dams or roadways or bring the water one way or the other. You got dirty as hell, but you spent the day up there, and then you came home and in the tub, washed up, and then you started
mentioned John Craig, and John was not only the good baseball player, he was a very good basketball player, and what impressed me playing basketball with John more than his ability, John had a tremendous sports head. John, if you were in the right place, you got the ball. If you weren't, you didn't get the ball. Wound up in the New York Giant organization, but then as his minor league career developed, he wound up turning his arm. You also mentioned the Indian Caves. The Indian Caves were the home of the Indians who supposedly snookered Peter Minuet into buying Manhattan Island. So it was the woods as it came to be known, the forest, the only forest in New York City, became the place that we first did things we didn't want people to see, like smoking cigarettes, which have killed many of us, and drinking and doing other things. But I have another person from the 516 area code on. Let's let him jump in and see who's calling from the 516 area code.
This is John Mulvey. John, how are you?
Hello, John Mulvey. John was speaking of basketball. John lived and died basketball. John was always on the courts with me. I was shooting, played a CYO ball, and so I assume that many of your memories had to do with basketball, John.
Who was that other gentleman who was on just before me, John?
Dennis O'Sullivan.
Dennis O'Sullivan. I played on a touch tackle football team with him, the Ijemeers, and we finished second. I remember we played in a mud bowl, and his brother, his late brother, was the quarterback. And
that's
I think
right.
Dennis,
Richard.
Richard. And Dennis, I think, kicked a field goal occasionally. And
John knows every shot he ever took, every game he ever played in. John is fantastic about his sports history. Go ahead, John.
Well, thank you. You were talking about Inwood Hill Park. Yeah, I do remember playing ball up there, and it was nice living so close to the park. I was only two or three blocks away. I was in, as you would say, Lower Seaman. I never looked upon it as Lower Seaman. I just looked upon it as Seaman Avenue. Actually, I lived a block away from the famous or infamous, however you'd like to describe him, the late Jerry Moran. He lived just like a half a block away from me. He lived the corner of Academy, and he was a pretty good athlete, by the way. Baseball. He played baseball, basketball, and football, but for his weight problem, he probably would have been a much better player. But
one of the funniest stories that we had with Jerry Moran, and I see one of the members waiting to speak. When the Giants moved to San Francisco, many of us had the New York Giant fans, and the first summer that they're out there, one of the locals, who was one of the glibest people I've ever met, who's been on this show many times, Chick Donahue, there was the park manager or something. He decided that we had to go to a giant game down in Philadelphia. Then he had the date of the giant doubleheader. He only had one problem. If we had no way of getting there, then we had no money. So the first thing that he did was went to Jerry Moran, and we laid the plan out, and Jerry agreed to finance the trip. But we didn't have a car. We found out that Bill Flynn, who played basketball with me, had a car, didn't work during the summer. So we went to approach him, and Jerry offered to pay his expenses, his car expenses, and Bill, seeing a mark, said, "Well, but I have to take the day off from work, and I won't get paid." And Jerry said, "I'll pay that too." So we head off to Philadelphia in Bill's white convertible, Jerry in the front seat, and Chicky and I, and Tom McCormick in the back seat, and we're heading down the parkway, and about 10 minutes out of Philadelphia, the sky's open, and we pull over and we put the top up. What do? We go into Philadelphia, and the doubleheader has been rained out.
Oh wow!
So there we are. So Bill pulls into one of these road ice cream parlors, and Jerry starts pulling up on malted. Two more at a time, and he's buying us stuff. So what are we going to do? It gets boring. So Chicky and I start calling girls of Collect in Inwood and telling them that we were Hobart, Jimmy Lambert. The only two people who took the call were Mary Beth Ball and Loretta Holland. And we tried to convince them that the Chicky was really Hobart, and they suspected that he wasn't, but eventually they hung up on us. Chick, do you remember that?
Of course I do. Not really. It was a long time ago, Johnny.
John, I didn't know you had Chicky Donahue on the phone.
He has just arrived. And another person from your graduating class who's waiting to get on is last week's guest, Frank Muldero. So I'll have some order here. Frank went to
Power.
I
have a story about Chicky Donahue, if you'd like it.
Go
You'll
ahead.
Probably oh. deny it. I remember Go. Playing cards up on 27th Street, the extension of 27th Street that went up into the woods there, and we usually had a game, and of course the money was in the center of the pot. And I remember there was a decent pot with a lot of quarters, and I remember playing, and what Chicky Donahue did was he put gum on the bottom of his shoes and walked through the pot, and he picked up about a buck and a half, which was a good percentage of the pot. And I'll never forget that. That was a pretty clever thing to do. And I think we chased him for a while, but we never caught him. I just wanted to reveal that and ask him about that. Does he remember that scam that he pulled on me?
Well, I can't deny it. It sounds like something I would do. But really, the guy who taught that trick to me and to anybody else who was interested was Foxy Moran.
Three Finger Peter
there
Moran.
You go.
Yeah.
There you go. And Foxy had a way of holding cards that just drew your attention to those three fingers. And while everybody was looking at his fingers, he had the gum on his hand and went across the pile. But I could have tried to up it because I didn't have that disformity of the finger of the hand. So I came up with a shoe. But I could have done that. That was
the only. The only thing I remember like that was playing cards behind the stadium over near we lived, and Jim Connors went shy three hands in a row as we're going around in the one hand, and all of a sudden he stood up to get money out of his pocket, supposedly, and flipped over the wall and took off. You know, he was one of the first people I ever saw just jump over the stadium wall and hit the ground running. Do you remember that, Frank?
I don't remember the incident, but he was a daredevil. What I do remember him, and you'll fill out the second guy, doing his climbing up the Henry Hudson Bridge. And when they got to the center, the two of them would sit opposite each other, staring at each other, and start leaning off the bridge to see who would quit leaning forward first. And usually Connors quit first. You remember the fellow I'm talking about, John?
Tommy
lived
Bunyan.
In 254. That's it, Tommy Bunyan.
And Tommy Bunyan.
Short-time resident of Inwood.
Actually hung by his feet around one of the girders taking the picture of a boat going under the bridge. And he scared the hell out of me, I'll tell you that right now.
I couldn't watch them. My stomach would get so upset, I couldn't watch them. But, I could imagine Jimmy leaping over. That stadium was, what, two stories?
Yeah. One thing that the chick brought out last week was that, and Dennis, you remember this, Chickie lived right by the dead end on Seaman Avenue. It was like we had to walk to the park. Chickie could just swing out of his house.
He was on 207th Street, right?
Yep. So
666, the last building on 207th Street.
Right.
Actually, west of Seaman Avenue.
Yes.
I have one other person from the 212 area code. Let me see who else is here. Who do I have from Inwood, from 567? I know who that is. This is a person who was in. He and Frank were in my class for the first day of Good Shepherd, and we started in February. And I knew Frank slightly from him being around the corner from him. But it was the first time that I had met Eddie Winnie. Did that ring a bell, Ed?
Yes, it does, John. How you doing?
I'm doing well, and they're on the air with another merchant seaman, one John Charles Dunnehy.
Oh, okay.
How are you, Eddie?
The first day of Good Shepherd in the first grade. I remember that because the second day I played hooky.
Where'd you go?
I went into the park. And made believe I was going to school because I was scared shit of the nuns. Pardon my French, but I remember that. Thank God it was a nice sunny day and I sat in one of those ballparks.
Tell me, do you remember what happened on the third day? I want to know what happened when you went back.
No, geez, I forgot about that. I don't know. I probably got hit on the knuckles with a ruler.
Well, Mom had to come in with you.
Probably.
The first day of school that I had there, Sister Mary Redemptor, who a number of you had experience with, pulled my hair in the morning. I went home for lunch, and I told my mother I was not going back. There was no reason for it. She pulled my hair, and my mother had to escort me back to school, and that was that. You had an experience, but
John,
did you?
John.
Yeah.
John, can I? I have a quick story for you. I've never told this before, though I wrote it down, but I didn't think anybody could accept it. You just gave me my license. My brother Billy and I, Billy's 15 months older than me, and I swore to his friends that he was only 6 months older than me. But Billy and I started Good Shepherd together. They wanted to keep us together. We looked like twins. And it was the same Sister Redemptor. And my father always preached to Billy and I when we were kids
that if there was if one of us got in trouble, the other guy was there to bail him out. And the first day in school at Sister Redemptor, I thought she grabbed him by the ear and was pulling him out of the class when I jumped her from behind and got her in a headlock. And that was the end of my first tenure at Good Shepherd School. And my parents were flabbergasted. Why did you attack the nun? And I couldn't understand why they would question me. They taught me, you know, she was beaten up on my brother, as far as I was concerned. So that's funny. Now, see, so she had a record. And she pulled your hair. That's great. Right. That's great to know. I'm going to look for other victims.
Good thing John didn't have a brother.
Dennis, did you have Sister Redemptor too?
You know, I don't remember. It was a bit of a fog as far as I was concerned. The first people I remember was the lady that used to be the matron down at the New Dykeman, Miss Gardner.
Miss
third
Gardner,
grade.
Yes.
And I remember her ruling with a long ruler, and yeah, very often you got a whack for whatever whatever transgression you you did.
I mentioned the last week, Dennis, that long before Ronnie Bloomberg in Major League Baseball, that Miss Gardner was the first designated hitter. I had her in I had Miss McGuire in the third grade, and she, as you probably know, was the aunt of Bobby McGuire, who became the police commissioner, and of Andy Lawler. Well, she didn't hit, so at about 2:30 every day in the classroom would come Miss Gardner, and she'd say, "Who's been giving you trouble? Anybody?" And sometimes Miss McGuire would say, "Well, Billy McFadden back there." She'd go, "Come here, boom!" That was the end of that. She was interesting. Dennis lived in a house on Isham Street. So without mentioning any names, then this is much later in our career. It had the first dog suicide that I knew about. Oh, yeah. There was a fellow who hung around with us who I remember Chickie telling him to put the spear down because I'm not your mother, and he lived in that house. After he got married, and he was rather excitable. So he went outside his apartment to do something, and his dog ran up to the roof, up the staircase. The roof door was open, and the dog jumped off the roof. He ran into his house to get the gun because he thought the dog was in misery and would have to be shot. He comes running downstairs. Now, all I can imagine, well, someone walking up the block on the Saturday afternoon, if just sitting in chambers for 4 hours, and seeing this dog come off the roof, and then this lunatic run out with a rifle, that would have been the last drink I would have had. So, do you remember that story, Frank?
I do remember the story, and I can't place the name of the guy, and I know him as well as you do. I mean, he lived right in the building next to us.
I can tell you a story about Chambers. When I was maybe in the second or third grade, there were two cops that had an altercation in there, and I saw them come out. They came out on Sherman Avenue, and there was a garage over there, and they went back to back, and they were going to have a duel.
A duel. Oh, man.
I don't think they ever fired, but it came pretty close, and I was looking out the window, and I can remember getting my, you know, just the slit of my eyes would be looking at the action. And, you know, that wasn't the only thing that went on in Chambers. They had a show a night over there.
For the record, only one of them was a cop, and that was John. I believe he lived on 213th Street. He was known to mutter the words, "My brother John, my brother John." He was a big monster of a guy, and how he got on the cops, he had to have some pull, And he spent exactly 20 years there. And when he told them he was going to not retire at 20, they said, yes, you are. But he was one of the guys, the two guys. The other guy was Lynch. And he had a detective shield from some town in New Jersey.
Oh, boy.
And he had a gun. I don't think he ever fired the gun. I don't know if the gun was ever loaded, but he had a gun with this shield. And the two of them had their guns out on right there at Isham and Sherman. And when they wouldn't put them away. And Patty Breen, was it Breen? It was a Patty Breen, or Breen sergeant. He was at the 3-4 at the time. And he came by in a car, and he had to plead with these two guys to put their guns away. And I'll never forget that. He was a real cop, a sane cop, and he's pleading with these two guys, who neither one of them could have been sane, at least at that very moment, to put their guns away. That was Inwood at its best. And they did.
The guy that I remember with a gun, and I never saw him actually wave the gun, but I heard stories, was a fellow who used to wear the pork pie hat and he used to hang out in the Grippos. And the only thing I remember about him was his nickname, Parksy. And I remember I remember sitting down at the end of the bar with Timmy Luddy and with PJ Lynn. And Parks up in the middle of the bar, and he took objection to Timmy making too much noise, and all of a sudden this bullet comes rolling down the bar, and Parks, he says, "That's my mark." We really didn't understand what that meant, but we figured it was time to go someplace else, take our business elsewhere.
He was one of the. Parksy kept his money in his hat. That's why he always wore a hat. And I never remember Parksy with a gun, but he certainly was capable. He was a World War II vet, saw a lot of action in Europe, and was an accepted eccentric, whatever. But always had flowers. Always had a flower, fresh flower. He kept paying our business in the slow times.
The words we've gone fairly rapidly in talking about bars, Chambers and Grippos. During my time in Chambers, I mean Inwood, from the late 1940s to the early 1960s, Inwood had more bars in it than any neighborhood in New York City. Walter Winchell called the Ginwood. And in many cases, it was just where we hung out. It was where we talked. We did a whole bunch of things. There were some bad things. There were some people who wound up drinking themselves to death. There was one fellow that tried to swim across the Hudson River under the influence, and it didn't work out. And we mentioned police and everything. It was a big civil service and good union neighborhood. My father was a cop. Frank's was the transit person. Jim Casey was a fireman. People came from union neighborhoods with loan sharking and would shape up jobs. It was a different time. Chick knows more about unions than most of us. You've told me some stories about people borrowing money and then the loan sharks getting them a job so they could pay it back.
One of the things that John, before the bar crowd was developed, I spent a lot of time in Charlie Costa's pool room. I don't know if any of you
yes.
have
oh,
shit. Experienced
yeah, sure.
that. And
setting pins. Remember setting pins?
That's right. I think Tuesday night they had they had a group that came down, and many of us went behind the pins, and we were pin boys for a
yep.
while. There was a guy down there that was a pin boy 7 days a week, and I remember
somebody got an idea. I can't remember the man's name, but you know, he was not a heavy hitter intellectually. Somebody nailed his shoes to the floor one day just for whoops. And he seemed not to be able to understand what the mechanics of that was, and he stayed there for about an hour before Mrs. Costa went down to find out where the hell he was, because somebody was looking to bowl, and he was supposed to be the pin boy.
Well, one of the
and
stories...
I don't know if any of you ever partook in the excursion one time. We went up to the Bronx, some party up there, and we got our ass kicked by some Bronx group. We were a little bit juiced up and came back and went down to Costa's and found a whole bunch of cue sticks.
Oh, geez.
And,
yep.
And went on the bus up to the Bronx to equalize the situation. And I remember being rounded up. That was the only time I got a ride in a paddy wagon up to the 50th precinct. I don't know if anybody was that's on the phone now was on in that group with me, but there was a guy up in the 50th precinct, Mr. Minogue, who had a bunch of sons, and he lived on Sherman Avenue, and I think he was an officer in the police department. And,
He was. Kevin.
I remember. I remember. After we got out of the paddy wagon, we were all lined up in a room with a table and take everything out of your pockets. And for whatever reason, I had a pair of rosary beads in my pocket, so that went on the table. And, holy crap! You know, here you are being arrested for being a. Somebody that's conveying punishment to a gang up in the Bronx. And so Mr. Minogue, I remember him getting hold of me and coming over and, you know, introducing himself to me. And I said, I know your sons, and no, they're not here. And he said, look, I'm going to talk to the officer in charge. I'm not in charge. I'm the deputy, your second in command. He said, I'll talk to the guy in charge. However, what I will agree to is talk to him to let you go if you promise never come to the Bronx again. So I had a promise that I'd never go to the Bronx again. And he let me go.
Well, but
where
I remember.
The 50th over by Van Cortlandt.
They used to be up on Bailey Avenue. Now it's down on now it's down near the Riverdale Diner. But the story I remember about Charlie Costa, other than playing pool there all the time, then yelling, on three, Lil, the Lil on three, was a party that Frank and Bill McLaughlin and I went to down Post Avenue at Pat McCarroll's house. And I didn't know any of the parents. I hardly knew the young ladies. They were a few years behind us. And then we've been drinking up in the park, and Bill tended to show his alcohol more than any of us. So all of a sudden, people are calling, is there the Mac here? Is there the Mac here? And I said, yes. And I go to the door, and who is out in the hallway but a bloody Chickie Dunny. And he said, I just wanted to tell you I can't come to the party because I got beaten up in the pool room. Now, number one, it wasn't my party. Number two, I didn't know that he was invited. But to tell me he can't go. It turned out that he was thrown down the stairs of Charlie Costa's by two very bad actors named Billy Corliss and Frankie Anderson. So I tried to talk him in, cleaned up, and he said, no, I'm going to go home. I'm not feeling him. So he leaves. And then Frank realizes that Billy's had too much to stay, so he takes Billy out. And then Billy is lying in the garden downstairs yelling up to apologize to the parents. It probably wasn't a good move. So the way I remember the story, and I'm sure that Chick will correct me if I'm wrong, Chickie's mother threatened to go to the police because of the way her son was handled, and the word got out that that call us who was the same guy I remember later, Frank, to knock Warren Hennessy out of the doorway in Bolarama. He sent the word out, tell the Donahue kid I'm not going to get him, we're going to get his mother. So Chickie went and talked to Gene Coghlan, who went into D&G where these miscreants hung around, and told him that he had adopted the Donahue kid. Now, I know hardly any of this. All I know is I'm standing in front of Benny's candy store, and Chickie, who would almost or really get me in trouble or a lot of things many times, says, but let's get a pizza. And I said, no, I don't want a pizza. He said, come on, I want to get a pizza. Let's get a pizza. And I said, no, I'm not. He said, I'll buy you pizza. So I said, no, I don't want a pizza. He said, well, come on, walk me over. So I walk him over. And just as we hit the doorway, he says, I saw Collis and Anderson go in here, and I don't know whether to what happened after Coghlan talked to them, to whether or not they're going to honor it. So we walk in the door, and I said, he's going to get me killed. And they just nod to us, and that was the end of that story, as far as I knew it. Why don't you fill in the blanks, Jim?
Well, it was long, long, long time ago. Actually, at that time, I worked as a park attendant at night from like 4 in the afternoon till midnight or 3 to 11 at Fort Tryon Park. And I had this, I used to go home for lunch, and it was on my trip home to lunch, for lunch and back to the park, about 8 o'clock at night, whatever. I had this altercation with Frank. I didn't know that Collis was also there at the time. I found out almost immediately later, but all I remember was Frank. And so I went back to work. I don't know if that was before or after the party. And when I got to the work, there was the cop who was assigned to the park. He used to, what did they call it, cooping? He used to coop in the park house there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I used to have a key. So I went into the park house, and I surprised them. So I they gave me a good beating. That was one of the better beatings I ever had. I had a few. He asked me what happened. I said I had a fight with a guy in the neighborhood. You know, he says, "Did you know the guy?" I said, "Yeah, I know the guy. It's Frankie Anderson." Well, it seemed that Frankie had was well known in the 34th precinct. And after that, they threatened my mother or whatever, and Aunt Florence, who ran the Democratic Club, got involved because Frankie's mother used to be a member of the club. So, of course, it was completely out of my hands. Within the year, I was in the Marines and gone, and I knew Piggy intervened. I never spoke to him about it, but I knew he intervened. And that was it. It was just part of growing up again and inward.
Yeah, Gene's no longer with us. He was. If you remember, he was Gene Tony's nephew. And it was interesting, Frank. I was at the party at Peter McGee's house. So I guess 9, 10 years ago on the Christmas, and this tall woman comes up to me and says, I know you. You're in the first grade with me, and I didn't remember. And I remember everybody. It was Madeline Coghlan, who was Jim's sister.
Wow.
I never made the connection that there were two of them. Did you?
I have no idea. I mean, you're expecting me now to? How many people were in our first? How many people were in our first grade class? 60.
Eddie, no, there weren't that many. Eddie, there was probably 40 people, weren't there?
There was more than 40 because I think a couple of guys doubled up in the desk.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it was closer to 60 because I remember a few people sitting together.
If I could name three, I'd be lucky.
Yeah, at that time we had a full school, you know.
There was
a lot of kids going to the school.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Well, they didn't charge tuition back then.
No, as a matter of fact, it was, we were lucky. It was pretty reasonable, whatever it was, if there was any charge at all. Yeah, you're right, I think, Frank, about that. You know?
There wasn't any. Did all, it all came out of the collection basket, and that's the
right.
problem that
I think you're right.
That they have now. That
and there were a few, you know, selling Christmas cards, and there were a few things that we were involved in, and to raise a few dollars for the school. But you're right, the parish surely did not want for money.
No.
When I was an assistant sacristan there, they had a bank account set up for years with enough money set aside to put air conditioning in Good Shepherd. But because the parishes south of us couldn't afford air conditioning, the archdiocese never let Good Shepherd become air conditioned, even though they had the money stashed.
Right.
So,
Chick, you,
it was a rich parish. But that brings us back to a story about
go ahead.
About Jerry Moran, right? What is that? And the Morans were always the number one contributor. Every year there was a list published in the weekly bulletin, one weekly bulletin, of the annual donors, like the top 50 or the top 20, 25, and the Morans roars at the top of that list. And then Mr. Moran got caught embezzling on Wall Street, right?
Yeah, Jerry didn't smoke or he didn't drink, and he didn't run around with women. He used to pay for our basketball uniforms when we were in the basketball league up in Kingsbridge. It turned out he was the compulsive gambler, and he was hitting the counts on Wall Street. He was the highest ranking operational person at Burnham & Company, and he's directly responsible for the regulation of the New York Stock Exchange, where if you have the brokerage account and if you change your address, they must send a confirmation to your old address and to your new address to make sure that there's nothing going on. What he had done is he had gotten into some accounts of very wealthy people who did not move their accounts. They were and he changed the name and address to him to the post office box. So he would get the records of the trades that he was selling out, always trying to win it back. And then he would type up, in the old days of typing, he would type up statements and so the people thought they still had stuff. The IRS was investigating some older woman, and because she hadn't paid capital gains tax. And the agent came to Moran when they were in looking at the books, and she said, you know, there may be something going on here. And Jerry said, I can't believe that. He said, I have the utmost confidence in my staff, but we'll have to discuss it after lunch. Boom. He was gone. He was up at Saratoga trying to win it back. Finally, he ran out of money, and he called up, and he was convinced to give himself up. He did 4 years, and at that time, if you were a convicted felon, you could not get bonding, and then you couldn't work on Wall Street. So he wound up working for the Marriage License Bureau of the city of New York until he retired.
Well, didn't know that
Dennis,
at all.
Dennis, do you remember Jeremiah Moran Sr.?
Yes. Yeah.
Good
very,
man.
Very, very, very generous.
Yep.
Always
good
had
man.
That reputation. And you know, I would know him to walk past him, but I wouldn't know him to talk with or anything beyond that. He was just in a different world than I was in. I was more interested in going up in the park and playing baseball and soon after that, I got involved with school and shit like that. So I really didn't, and the canoe club. You haven't mentioned anything about the canoe club. I was a member of the Inwood Canoe Club. When I was about 14, I bought a canoe from Carl Listel. I don't know if you remember that
name,
the Listels.
Sure.
Yeah.
You had Carl, and you had Robert.
Bobby and Marty.
And Marty.
Yeah.
Marty was in the Inwood Canoe Club, and Marty. Marty played. Bob was a boxer. Remember, I used to meet him. I worked for AT&T, and I used to go to the gym down at the West Side Y, and he was there, and he was taking boxing lessons, or he had a trainer, and he was fighting, and he battled the Bayonne Bleeder. Remember that name?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Chuck Webner.
Yeah, Chuck Webner.
There were two Bayonne Bleeders. There was Gus Levinovich who fought Joe Louis, and then it was Chuck Webner who later lost Chow Lee. And do you remember who his manager was? Chickie, you ought to know who his manager was.
Who, Bobby's manager?
Yeah.
No, I don't. I'm so hold. Was it Louis Farragut?
Yes, it was.
I don't remember.
Louis Farragut talked his way into the Kojak show as a retired disabled police officer, and he was there as a technical advisor. And then in the end, they got him onto the show. He was the guy who used to bring the stuff in to tell Savalas and say, "Lieutenant, this just came in," and he was on there for a good 2-3 years, and until someone blew the whistle on him. What do you
see? He was Detective Cleary. He
right.
Started out as a security guard in the studio, and when they were filming, they were doing something like they stepped on a chalked out, supposedly dead policeman, and somebody walked across it. And as a security guard in uniform, he chastised that guy to show more respect for the chalk lines and everything. And he got their attention. He told them he was a motorcycle cop, had an accident, was out on three quarters, and they hired him as a technical advisor. He did 5 shows. I used to go out to visit him. That's how I know all of this. He did 5 shows and then talked his way into being Detective Cleary. And until somebody dropped a dime on him, but... He was living the life of a. I'd get off the plane. He'd have a big red rented Cadillac convertible and pick me up and take me out to the fancy joints where all the action was and Malibu Beach and places like that.
Terry Chigrou was in the car with him one day and they got stopped for speeding or something. Then Louis tried to pull it off with the motorcycle cop saying, "I left my tin at home." that didn't go down at all. No. So
yeah.
Yeah, Louis is no longer with us.
No, God rest his soul. You know, you mentioned something about the union and the hiring hall, and there was a gentleman last name was Clinton, associated with the Laffers. And he was a bit of a loan shark. And he hung out in Sam's. And the Laughters, I believe, got paid on Wednesday. So every Wednesday night, you would go to Sam's and pay Clinton. And I guess it was 6 for $5 in those days. But at that time, I remember some young guy came to me, had just got married or was between jobs, and he needed to borrow $20. That was a lot of money back. I'm guessing talking in the 60s. And I told him, I said, "No, you don't need $20, I said, because you're going to have the same problem next month. You need some work." So he says, "Yeah, but there ain't no work around." I said, yeah, this is what you do. Go down to Sam's. This is what you tell Clinton and borrow $20, and he'll give it to you. And then, but I won't have it to give him back, he said. That's okay. You go back the following Wednesday and tell Mr. Clinton, don't lie to him now, tell him, I'm very sorry, Mr. Clinton, but I don't have your $20 plus the big. I went shaping every day down at the hall, the Lathis Hall, and I couldn't get any work. So Clinton would say, all right, son, glad you came and told me. He says, you go down the hall tomorrow morning, he gave him a little piece of paper, ask for so-and-so, and tell him you're shaping. And that's how Clinton was assured that he'd get, the kid would get paid $20 for the day at least. And Clinton would get his, it was the best guarantee you could get on a loan around town.
He lived next door to me. And I remember after they moved to New Jersey, they had a bungalow in the same court that you had, Chicken, in Rockaway. And I remember Bill McLaughlin and I spending the night your aunt's bungalow once or twice.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. And he just moved his business. He must have got heat in New York. He moved his business over to Palisades Park, New Jersey. Not the amusement park. The town of Palisades Park, which abutted Cliffside Park. It was on a hill. Cliffside Park was on the top where the amusement park was. And down the bottom of the hill on the west side was Palisades Park. And in the middle of the hill, I think he did it purposely to be on what side of the line he was on. He worked out of a bar there. Because, as you know, in Inwood, once you got in debt, you always in debt.
Dennis, you mentioned the canoe club. The canoe club, for being just one club in northern Manhattan, I know at least four people went to the Olympics out of there, including my friend John Walters and Bill Kelly. Why were you so successful?
I think it was just a we had a fellow there. You may remember the name Eric Feit.
Yeah.
Eric was a fireman. He worked a pump truck for the fire department, and he spent a lot of time at the canoe club. And I think after the Second World War, a lot of people came back from the war, and they just weren't ready to do work or anything else. And they went down to the canoe club, so that was by way of background. In the late 40s, they used to, on occasion, get into a canoe, and they would go up, they would paddle up the river, and they would tell us that they went to Montreal and do those kinds of feats because they had nothing else to do. We never went that far, but we went 3 or 4 days up the river, maybe just shy of West Point, camped up there, and came back down. And it was an intriguing place in that you didn't go drinking. You went out exercising, and there were I remember
that would have let us out, Frank, right?
Well, how old were you then? How old were you when you
me?
Joined the club.
I think I was in the age category. I was still in high school, maybe 17.
Okay.
In that range. And then I stuck with it, and we recognized that we couldn't draw enough talent from the neighborhood. So I had a contact. I went to LaSalle Academy, and there was a brother there, and he taught over at St. Raymond's. And then we had another contact because another kid that we knew was in Yonkers, and he went to Manhattan Prep. So Manhattan Prep, we talked Manhattan Prep, and we talked St. Raymond's into sending some kids down, and they took to the place. So we had easily a dozen to 15 that were down there, and after the Olympics, the Olympic year was very intense, but the next year was a barren place. There was nobody there because you just were worn out from all of this training and everything else. And we could never figure out why we couldn't win a goddamn medal. And I remember Kenny Wilson.
Yeah.
You may remember that name. His brother. Dennis Denden. Well, Kenny Wilson, I remember talking with him, and he says, I'm going to go over to Romania, and I'm going to find out
why the hell those people are so good, and we're working our buns off, and we can't compare to them. And he went over there. We had made a contact through a canoe club, and he went over there, and he lived over there for 3, 4, 5 weeks. And when he came back, he says, I still can't understand it. He said they had no meat. It was so run down economically that they had in their economy, they had no way to feed these guys the way you would need to be fed if you were an athlete. So it was always a question mark. We were naive. And now I'm watching TV, and I'm finding out that many of the war people from Germany and even the Americans were drugged to allow them to continue to exist and to fight and to carry on in spite of having little or no food, in spite of frost and everything else. You know, it was a we were just naive to the issue of drugs, and that's my understanding of what it might have been. But we
I remember
guys,
you
I'm
sent...
going to have to say so long, and I would like to take a minute and just say Merry Christmas, everybody. And John, thanks for bringing everybody together.
Yes,
okay.
I agree with you, Frank.
Merry Christmas, Frank.
Happy holidays to everybody.
Be well. Dennis, I remember that Kenny Wilson and Walters went together, and two Kellys went. Were they the only ones from your time that went over the Olympics?
Now, we had a couple of kids that went over in K2s. K is kayak, and two is two men in the boat. You had K1, you had K2, and you had K4. The Olympic was K1, where you sat in a boat, and K2, where two people sat in a boat, and then you had what is called the sea boat, which is you kneel in a boat, one man kneels, and then two men yield. I just received an old correspondence from a fellow I knew that was a retired guy, and he qualified for the Olympics just before the Second World War, 1938, I think. And they just didn't hold the Olympics, and I can't keep track of the years or the non-years. So they had a rich... the other thing is we had a good relationship with Yonkers Canoe Club, and they had a couple of... their members went to the Olympics. O'Rourke is one name that I recall. And so we were close. I tried very hard, but I just was not capable. I just didn't have the abilities.
I know the Walters and Kenny went to Rome, and didn't one of the Kellys go to Australia?
Yes, yeah. Steve,
Dennis,
not Billy.
Dennis.
Billy never went. Steve went. Steve was in Rome also.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question, Dennis, about the canoe club? As a kid, 8, 9, I used to hang out down there along the river, just, you know, being a kid, hanging out with the people who had their runabouts and everything. And they,
yes.
I would get rides. And actually, yep. Some guy at my 10th birthday, he gave me a 10-footer canoe as a gift. It was an old piece of crap, but it was mine. And I had my own boat, and they never charged me anyway. And it was around that time, so I'm guessing it was 1951, that and there was an airplane place down there, a hangar. And
yes, there was. A Qantas plane
used to take off. And they even had for a brief period of time, a ferry boat that went across to the Palisades Park, a park on the other side of the river that was part of the Interstate Parkway on the water. But
yes,
my question
correct.
Is this. The city ripped all of those places down at one time over a period of a year or two, with the exception of the Inwood Canoe Club. And we were told, if you inquired, because I was hanging out in that other little motorboat place, they said, well, they said they're not going to rip that down because it produces Olympic rowers. And that they had some Olympic rowers in that club, and the city wanted to keep it there as an encouragement to the whatever. Do you know if there's any truth to that?
I do know that there were. I'll mention some names. DeGiorgi was a boat club down there. You may remember
that's
that
name. That's the one I was in.
Yeah, and they had a substantial number of people. But what happened with some of those, there was Interstate Boat Club also, another one down there. There were about four or five, and they were places where family people from Inwood, Washington Heights could come. They had a boat. They could lift it out of the water and put it inside. And when they wanted to go down there on a evening or a night, they put it back in the water and went out and buzzed around and came back in. Many of those places were wrecked by heavy-duty storms. The storms beat the crap out of the places were not substantial. As far as the Inwood Canoe Club was concerned, remember there was a group of screwballs that ran around, and they were called Wilding. For some reason, they were given that name. Well, they set fire to the Inwood Canoe Club. It used to be a wooden building, and we had I had two boats in there. I had two canoes, and the whole place went up in flames, and everything was lost. It just burnt right down to the deck. And I was up here in Connecticut at the time, and I'm a consulting engineer, so I was dealing with a lot of contractors, and I got a hold of a contractor, and I told him I wanted a metal building built starting Saturday morning, and I wanted finished by Sunday night. And so what they did was they put a metal building. They had the ability to do that. They put a metal building on a truck. A couple of days before, they drove down there. They slept over down at the boathouse, and they finished. And what you have down there now, I don't know if you've ever been down there now. It's quite a bit different, but there is a metal building that is the Inwood Canoe Club. And it was in the there was just a story about it in one of the newspapers. Maybe it was the The Post, I think it might have been, that there are people that are going down there. It's now turned into social, more social. But I see that space that is next to the Hudson River on the river side of the railroad tracks and the highway. I think at some point they're going to go down there and they'll put in a driveway, because that is a very attractive, relatively easy place to recreate. And if you go down there right now, there's a tremendous Spanish club down there. I don't know if you've ever been down there recently. I went down there for some function, and I'm coming up the street, and there was two Spanish girls going down there. Well, the distance between the top of their dress and the bottom of their dress was no more than 24 inches, and they were heading down there looking for action. So it's a very, very attracted place. You cannot get a parking space down there. There's Dyckman Street up to Broadway is filled because of this
Chick,
club now that's down there.
Chick, you mentioned that Sister Redemptive, that your episode with her ended your first tenure at Good Shepherd. When was your second tenure?
Well, you know, politics being what it is, John, you know, like Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. I wound up banished to PS 98 for 5 years. And in the meantime, my mom, I didn't know, and they didn't even really know, but I had difficulty reading. I couldn't read. I found out at the age of 72 that I lived my entire life with dyslexia. and a whole bunch of dyslexia is split up into a whole bunch of different ways, but I have all of them. And that was part of my problem. And my other, as a result of that, I was a bad student. So, and psychologically, whatever, I did other things to get their attention or whatever. But they finally allowed me to come back to Good Shepherd, and I should have went into the sixth grade. And they allowed me to start there. I was there about a month. I couldn't keep up, so they put me back a year. And so I went into the back into the fifth grade, and I finally graduated in 1956. But I like to,
now,
say, to tell people, when, you know, did you get in trouble when you were in school? I said I got kicked out of every school I went to, including Catholic school in the first grade. I don't know how bad. How I can't get no worse than that.
So how did you ever be able to, if it was not diagnosed till after you had the Harvard degree, how did you ever get through 2 years in the MPA program?
Well, first of all, during my life, nobody tried to diagnose it. Nobody recognized it as a problem. It was either lazy or stupid or whatever. Whatever a troublesome kid would be, that's what it was. There was no proper diagnosis for it. I only found out about it when one of my grandchildren was diagnosed with it, and my daughter, with a graduate degree from Columbia and was very much into that type of work, read over the phone to me all of the symptoms of it. And I said, my God, I have every one of them, or I had every one of them. And then we looked further, and that's what it was. It was a great revelation to me in the sense it explained to me how, and more important, why I did some of the, I couldn't not be explained any other way, than dumb things that I did in my childhood for a whole host of reasons. But I everything I did backwards. I had to figure out a way to get something done. And I did few things the regulation way. I found a way to get to where I wanted to get, but I never knew I had a disease or nothing. I just thought all these other people were stupid. Why are they doing it this way? It's a lot easier over here. And that's, I had to actually lobby to get into Harvard. I got a decent SAT score, and I did take some classes at the Empire State Labor College. Well, that's when I was active with the union, and I did, you know, collective bargaining and, you know, and labor law and things like that. But I never had, the last formal education I really had was Rice High School for a year. But I had to lobby to get in. And at that time, it was the height of my political career as a trade unionist. I never ran for office. I was a technician or something. I ran campaigns. I was one of the few guys who could put together a large phone bank. I used to run statewide phone banks for elected officials who were endorsed by the AFL-CIO or the building trades. And I also became an expert on the complicated ways of getting through the petition process in the Democratic Party in New York State, particularly in New York City. So I knew all of these people, and I was very good at it. I was a decent organizer, and what would you say? Not by the book. I had to invent ways to achieve whatever our goal was, and I was fairly successful. So I had these politicians who, you know, I had like Geraldine Ferrara, Mario Cuomo, Moynihan was the most important, and every one of them I had run campaigns for the labor end of it. So they were all helpful, and, you know, I needed a committee to actually speak up for me
and write about their experiences with myself to justify Harvard to do this, to grant somebody admission to the graduate program without an AB or a BA. And there's my dyslexia right there. AB, BA, whatever.
Dennis, I'm not sure you're aware. You probably are. The Chickie has a master's in public administration from Harvard, and Joanna Malloy who's next Daily News gossip columnist. She's been writing a book about Chick, his experiences in Vietnam as merchant seaman when he delivered a beer to guys from Inwood, and there's this terrific YouTube video that was paid for by Pabst Blue Ribbon, that used to be my hip cord can to preference, that was filmed in the Piper's Kilt on 230th Street when Chick got together with three of the four guys that he had delivered beer to during his beer run in Vietnam.
Since this is an Inwood crowd, mention their names.
Tom Collins, Ricky Dugan, then who's the other one?
Bobby Pappas.
That's right. Did
Chickie,
you know them,
Dennis? No, I did not. Chickie, let me ask you. I know my recently my sister, Kathleen O'Sullivan, she got together during the Vietnamese War, and she and a number of girls from Inwood put together an Inwood newsletter, and she mailed it to people in the Army over in Vietnam. And she's attempting now to get copies and to make contacts and the like. Were you aware of that newspaper?
I was aware of the newspaper, and it really it's a great document. It tells so much about Inwood and the structure of Inwood, the social structure, the women
right.
doing all of this, the girls, they were girls, teenagers.
Yeah, they were girls.
For most part. And,
yep.
And the boys playing sports and all of that. I have some copies of that.
Wow.
I don't have it in my possession now, but in my co-author's research efforts, we discovered some of these things. I forget right now who we got them from, but I think we got them from a couple of different people in Inwood who, you know, they were mostly all related somehow to the Vietnam era and to the 26 people we believe were killed out of Good Shepherd Parish over there. So, yes, I do have some copies of them. I don't have them in my presence right now, but they're in our research. We have a lot of research stuff, and I'll make sure we'll make copies of anything, any of them, and get a copy of that somehow to you, probably through John.
Yeah, that'd be great. And my sister, I know that she's trying to reestablish this information, and they were young ladies, and they didn't keep copies, and they weren't organized in that manner. But I think it's a tremendous story, and it would be perhaps complementary to what you're putting together. So,
well, it is, and I did read them, the ones that I have, possession of, and they were very, very, very thorough. I mean, I didn't realize how many football teams there were, and mostly out of the bars, but not necessarily out of the bars, like the K&R, the Forest, they had a team, right?
Yeah,
and,
the
Ishimias. How many of them had
a baseball team,
both male and female. It was a very active community, and it was all recorded by these young women. I don't think there was a male, not one male.
No, there was not.
I don't remember one male's name.
Another team was the Ishimias, and we had no bar affiliation. That was
okay.
One of the teams
that
I was on.
That's what I said. I don't have it in front of me, but I remember, and I was very impressed by it.
It was not, well, maybe in the Library of Congress it might have been an amateur thing, but to anybody from Inwood, it's a beautiful thing to read.
Well, that'd be great if you keep that in mind, and I'm sure that whatever she does, I'll make sure that you get a copy of whatever she puts together also.
Good. No, that's great. That's great.
It's interesting. We're in the middle of a culture change. My generation was the first, and Dennis is part of it, as was Frank, of the college generation. Our family was like the group, the Chickie and I, and Dennis has been there once, go to McLean Avenue once a month, the Narrowbacks. Most of the guys that I hung around with, they went to college, and most of them finished. It was also the last generation where others could join the workforce an entry-level job right after high school and wind up as officers in brokerage firms and in banks like Leo Dolan. It's all changed, but the neighborhood seems to be coming back to, in some ways, the way that it used to be. Good Shepherd School was in almost closed because the archdiocese wanted to shut it down, and Richie Scalata and John Brennan and Manny Ramirez, who owned Addictive Drugs, they got together and they brought the school back. St. Jude's, that had been carved out of Good Shepherd, has been put back into Good Shepherd now. Queen of Martyrs,
right?
Queen of Martyrs is still very active. It was, and the neighborhood is different. East of Broadway is heavily Dominican. West of Broadway, northwest, is still Irish and Jewish and Yuppified up where I was. It's very, very expensive co-ops. The neighborhood has obviously changed. There used to be three movie theaters right in the neighborhood. And I remember, that's another Johnny U story. I remember Chickie trying to get up on the stage in the new Dykeman Theater when Joanne Campbell was singing, a beautiful blonde without much talent. And I believe that you were knocked back off the stage by a police officer. Do you remember that?
No, I don't remember that. I do remember competing with, who was the guy with the little banjo? Came from the Heights. Tiny Tim.
Tiny Tim.
I was there that night.
They had a talent show there every Saturday. And you could register for the talent scout show. And I registered for the talent scout show on a number of occasions. Some occasions I actually won. But this one really pissed me off because most of the contestants, if not all of them, were from Inwood. And this guy came, and I didn't think he should have been on the stage because he came from the Heights. But I remember him winning, and that upset me.
I remember that night. I remember that night he was there. Yes. Tiny
Tim. Was your talent? What was your talent, Chick?
Oh, I could sing.
Yeah, I remember... we were talking about this last week, Dennis. Chickie and I and Frank Muldero used to often be at Bill McLaughlin's apartment because Mr. McLaughlin, he was a tremendous singer. He loved to sing. And there was always a way you could go to get the can of beer, particularly if you were underage. And it was just singing all night and drinking beer and having
Mr. McLaughlin sang in St. John's Church there.
St. Margaret's. St. Margaret's, Chick.
In Marble Hill?
No, St. Margaret's. St. Margaret's up in Riverdale. He went all the way up there.
I thought it was the other one. Okay.
And he used to sing On the Road to Mandalay. Marvelous voice. And it was like having Rockaway on 215th Street, if you remember. Dennis, did you go to Rockaway at all?
No, not to stay over. No, we went down day trip. That's it.
Okay. I remember drinking in the afternoon and in the early evening at the Leitrim Castle and then going across to Mia Cotton's Mayo House to hear Ruthie Morrissey sing "The Dying Rebel" and "The Green on the Green," and Chickie's family had a bungalow, and his aunt had one right across from it. Where was it, Chick? 105th Street or 104th?
It was between 105th and 106th. We rented them. And
okay.
It was my aunt. She had one. We had one. And depending on what kind of year you had financially, if you didn't have a good enough year, you could rent for a month maybe. But we were never in the same bungalow.
But you used to be there at the end of the season party down Labor Day, because I remember drinking beer on your court down there with Billy, too.
Sure.
Yeah.
Literally barrels of beer on the porch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the neighborhood changed, but we still have a few things. We always seem to get into trouble when we went out of the neighborhood, like on the Ram boat ride, when Albie would jump overboard, or Peter Stanford would get locked up or whatever. We always seem to feel much better staying in our neighborhood than Dennis going off to Van Cortlandt Park and being arrested, or Chickie taking us up to visitation and getting us in a brawl and all that kind of stuff. You know, we should have stayed in Inwood all the time.
I think it was a conspiracy by our parents to keep us there. We were safer. Well, we couldn't get in that much trouble.
Yeah.
That's right. Wouldn't get shot.
All right, John, I'm going to go. Mickey, wonderful
Dennis,
talking with you.
Dennis, we're about to wrap up. Do you have anything else that you want to add to the conversation before we go?
No. I'm going to contact my sister and see if I can get her alert to see what she's doing with some of the stuff.
If you get her to email me, I will put her and Chick in contact with the two emails, because I've got them both. Chick, do you have anything to add?
No, John. I just thank you again for making this possible. You know, I'm retired in Florida, and people seem to disappear when I retire, and geez, it's like I'm back in the capital now.
Yeah, this is 2 weeks in a row with you. Thank you very much, Chick.
Then we'll go off
in a minute, and we'll go off the way we used to wrap up the Lone Ranger. Good night, everybody, and thank you very much.
Good night.
Good night.